6 is on Aether, and I'll turn it over to Jeff for that.
Yeah, so item 6, this is a re-up with Aether, Aether Real Assets Fund 4, the sequential fund to Aether Real Assets Fund 3. Aether, alongside Common Fund, are real assets fund of funds managers focusing primarily on the natural resources space. When Cesera's private real asset program was funded in 2013, Aether was one of the original managers. It's been about 2 years since then, so the natural fundraising cycle has brought them back to market with Aether Real Assets Fund 4. A quick review of the fund's strategy. Aether generally builds relatively concentrated fund of funds portfolios, somewhere about 10, but 8 to 12 underlying partnerships. What they look for in those partnerships are smaller fund size. They feel like there's better alignment with the GP and the investors in the smaller funds. There's also the opportunity to get into nichier end assets. Earlier funds in the GP's life cycle, so the underlying fund general partner funds kind of 1 through 3 are where they like to enter. They feel like they have more influence over the GP's decision-making process if they're in those earlier funds. And they are looking for managers and GPs that have some technical expertise in what they're going after. So a manager of farming assets should have a farming background. The Aether as a firm has changed a little bit since the last time you've seen them. In 2013 when they were hired, they were a firm of 5 people. They're now a firm of 8. They've added 2 people in the investment sourcing and diligence support roles and 1 person to cover operations. But the bigger change was actually brought to the board last August, which was a change in the ownership of their management company and the general partnership. When we saw Aether in 2013 and when they were established, their management company and the general partnership had split ownership between the senior members of Aether and Northern Lights Capital Group. Northern Lights Capital Group is a investor in early stage asset managers. What happened last August was Aether, in exchange for 100% ownership of the general partnership, gave the management company to Northern Lights. The management company collects management fees, issues a budget, pays salaries, and keeps the lights on, where the general partnership collects carried interest if it's earned. We've met with Aether and Northern Lights since that transaction happened. We don't see it as being material to Aether's ability to run the portfolio. We've gone over our commitments to Aether from Aether Real Assets Fund 3. One thing we want to point out is that in 2013, we made a $75 million commitment that was spread across 2 implementation vehicles, which was due to a capacity constraint in the main fund of Aether. Aether themselves tend to raise smaller funds. Aether Real Assets Fund 3 was a $300 million fund. Real Assets Fund 4 is anticipated to be about $350 million. We did $25 million in the main fund and $50 million in the surplus fund. The strategy of the surplus fund is the same as the main fund. The primary difference there would be in the event the main fund gets into a capacity-constrained underlying partnership, the surplus fund may not participate in that. So the main fund has priority on all new investments. If those investments are capacity constrained, the surplus fund doesn't participate. Since that structure has been established, there's been about 1 partnership that has been in the main fund and not in the surplus fund. The surplus fund and main fund construct is present for Real Assets Fund 4 as well, and we are asking for discretion over the implementation vehicle pending their fundraising and capacity constraints. So our ability to commit, which includes the detail from the previous memo with the 100% overcommitment to fund of funds, is on page 6. As you get to the bottom of the table, $63 million available to commit, and we're asking for a $50 million commitment. So with that, we can open for questions before we bring the Aether guys in.
How much is this fund trying to raise?
Its target to be $350 million.
Its target for what?
$350 million.
What's first closing? What's the target for first closing?
They're anticipating more than likely a first and final close, but they may go to a second close, and they're looking at end of October or early November for that.
And what's what they're saying, $300 million
done.
For them?
One and done. Yeah, all 350.
Really? How much have they collected so far towards that fund?
In with the private fund, they don't actually collect anything until they close. So their current level of commitments come from meetings like this where a board may commit but hasn't signed docs. So it's not necessarily a public a public number. We can ask them what they've soft circled if they want to disclose that.
Did they disclose it to you at all? They won't?
At this point, they have not.
So we don't really know how much is being committed to this fund by other public.
It's all happening right now. So during the research process here, a lot of our contemporaries are conducting their own research process as well. And so it's kind of happening in real time. And so we can get the updated number from them. What we know they communicated to us is that conversations have been such that they think that all $350 million is spoken for. The folks who have, quote unquote, spoken for it think they can be in the first close. But this is a moving target. So if the first close ends up being $250 million and folks come in a little bit later, that's possible. But to give guidance in advance, it's a little bit difficult because it is a moving target. We'll get the update from them as to where they stand today.
Okay. $50 million of 300 and what is it, 320 million? 350. Is what percentage? Is that 1/6? 1/7. Okay. On page 8, investment restrictions. I want to read you a paragraph because I'm not sure I understand it. Okay. Yeah. Investment restrictions. No more than 30% of the fund commitments will be committed to real asset sectors. Asset sectors that are not oil and natural gas, metals and minerals, or agriculture and timber. So what are the other things that they're talking about?
So probably the easier way to phrase that, that's a line taken from their LPA. 70% of their assets are going to be deployed into the sectors that you mentioned. The 30% flexible is opportunistic sectors. And what those are to Aether are alternative energy, water, things that fall in that space. If you look at their historical allocations to this, they've been relatively small, primarily, and I believe, the first two funds.
So think of it this way. They're communicating to you where their bread and butter is in these asset classes, these asset segments here. They also want to be cognizant of, they don't know, because remember, they're going to be out there in the market for a number of years deploying capital. So they're going to say, we don't know what might come up. We want to maintain some flexibility to deploy up to 30%
outside. So they're saying they're holding that 30% back for something that is other than what they traditionally have been.
Depending on what they see, up to 30%. It could very well be zero.
Yeah, it's not a hard and fast. It may be 100% into their core primary sectors. But if something comes up, they have the flexibility to take it.
In Milliman's report, it's a little over a year ago, they didn't exactly point this out as a shortcoming. They just said it's unclear as to whether or not they'll be deploying through additional funds. And now it appears that question's been answered. So, but I don't know exactly how to read that. Is that plus or minus or a source of concern or not a concern? Obviously, they are raising funds or money for new funds. So what have we concluded from Milliman's observation that there was a lack of clarity?
I think that the lack of clarity was more focused on there were a small firm that went through an organizational change, which, as you look down the line, saying, what does this mean for future funds?
Right.
I think Milliman's memo did highlight that there's long-term employment contracts through funds 4 through 7. Mm-hmm. So raising an additional fund, I think this was more or less something that's always been on their radar. Historically, they've raised a fund about every two and a half years. So this is keeping up with that pace.
Right.
Again, with the change in the management company and general partnership ownership, we don't see it as impeding their ability to raise a fund. We think the incentives are aligned appropriately. So
we've now determined that basically not much has changed.
It's not that not much has changed. It's that their operations aren't materially impacted to do what they were going to continue to do.
Right, okay.
We understood what was going to happen in Fund 4 or 5. The question mark is about 5 to 6 years in the future. That question mark remains.
Okay.
For future funds.
All right.
But there's not a question mark on this fund that we're underwriting today.
Okay. Well, that's a good distinction. Thank you.
Jeff, what strikes me is that we are in 2008-09, figuratively, in these three sectors. They've just gone through a bloodbath. Either we're going to be incredibly smart, getting in at the bottom, buy low, sell high, on all three of these, or we're somewhere in the path, still on the way down. The timing is absolutely classic, I think. How much concern do either of you have on where we are in their cycles? I'm talking about metals, minerals, oil, gas.
Well, with part of that, we definitely are cognizant on the staff level of kind of the valuation of all the underlying assets that these portfolios are picking up. But with the fund-to-fund structure, there's kind of a two-tier deployment of capital. First, Aether is finding managers that they want to invest with, and then those managers are finding investments. So this is the difference, so to speak, of private investment in commodity-sensitive assets and direct investments in the commodity-sensitive assets. If we were buying the spot price of nickel and silver and oil right now, there would be a huge question mark over, is this going to go down even further? Is this going, or have we hit the bottom and it's going to turn around? On the private side, you have more tangibility, especially when you're actually buying the working interests in the oil and gas fields and the producing mines. So valuation, yes, these have come down. You can see that they've taken their valuation sensitive as well as you've seen oil and gas and metals and mining be the primary sectors that they've allocated to over their past few funds. That's where the opportunity has been due to the lower prices. To answer your question on timing directly, I think that's an Aether role. Our deployment of capital doesn't all happen today. It happens over their investment period, so it should be mitigated to some level.
And candidly, the weighted average date of the deployment of capital is about 3 years in the future, maybe five.
So maybe we're back at the peak.
I doubt it. I mean, if you think about the last couple of conversations we've had in this boardroom about commodities, we've been focused on the oil and gas segment in our partnership with Angelo Gordon. And we were pretty candid with the board at that point in time that we did not recommend a private equity allocation to the oil and gas segment. We thought it was way too early to be starting to buy ownership of these, but we were very comfortable with a debt-oriented structure where we could foreclose. Mm-hmm. But we did highlight for the board that we thought there was going to be a private equity entry point sometime in the future. That's these guys. Okay. They are a strategic allocator, but they should be deploying into an advantageous market. So the timing is at our back, but strategically this makes sense kind of almost regardless of valuation. I hesitate to say that because valuation is very, very important to us internally, but the strategic marching orders from the board are maintain exposure to this space. The entry point might be doubly advantageous.
Good answer. Good.
What traditionally has been the maximum interest that we will put into a fund? 10%, 5%, 20%, what is it?
In the public equity realm, you've expressed an interest to generally stay below 10% of the strategy base. In the private space, we have not had such a limitation. It's been sized relative to the opportunity set.
And I hear, because I looked in the policy, when I read the policy, I couldn't find it anywhere.
You don't have a policy, you have a historical practice.
Yeah.
And the historical practice really doesn't apply to fund-to-funds, because if we say Aether is raising a $350 million fund, well, they're a smaller investor in this broader swath of the underlying general partnerships. So our 1/7th position in an Aether fund is then spread across this larger asset base here. So it's not a clean answer that you're looking for that we see in the public equity markets, but we're a relatively modest portion of the overall deployment here.
And you're okay with 1/7th?
I'm absolutely okay with 1/7th.
All right.
Okay.
Motion to approve.
Oh, no. You want to hear the presentation?
They can't come in.
They did. Aether.
We have the professionals from Aether here. We'll go.
We can skip the presentation.
No, go. Go.
We're good to bring them in then, it sounds like?
Yeah.
They're going to be pleased at how well their presentation went.
Yeah, how well it went. Didn't know they were even out.
Send them home, Jerry.
Yeah, I didn't even know they were out here. Hello.
Tell them to turn the meters off.
Yeah.
Morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Morning. We have one more coming, you just ran to the restroom, so naturally.
Faster than anyone.
I know the call.
She who hesitates is lost.
Say one more is coming.
Yeah, that's probably him right there. The dramatic entrance.
Go ahead and pregnant pause. So he probably doesn't.
Good morning. Let me, I know one of you will take the lead and introduce your colleagues and go into your presentation.
Sure, I'll be happy to do that. Thanks for having us. I'm David Rhodes. I'm Aether's Chief Operating Officer. I'm joined by Sean Goodrich and Troy Schell, Aether's co-founders and portfolio managers. So in case there are some new board members since the last time we were here, Aether's a boutique investment manager. We're based in Denver, Colorado, and we're focused exclusively on managing real assets. So today we manage just a little over $900 million in committed capital across three fund series, all within our single real assets investment strategy. We're currently raising our fourth fund, Aether Real Assets 4, or ARA4 as we'll refer to it today. And that's what we're here to talk with you about, as well as the overflow surplus fund. We'll be holding a closing for both those funds in November, which we've communicated with Jeff and Tim and the staff, so you're aware of that. Real quickly, a couple organizational updates. Since we were here presenting to the board last time, we've concluded the restructuring transaction with Northern Lights Capital. As you'll recall, they purchased a portion of Sean and Troy's management company interests, and in exchange for that, we received the carried interest in our 100% of the carried interest in our funds going forward. In addition, we'll be making 100% of the general partner commitment to those funds, beginning with ARA4. So, we think that's a pretty important aspect since it increases our alignment with our investors and also allows us to spread the carry more broadly across our entire team. We also retain operational control. So we make the same decisions with regard to investment management or business decisions as we did pre-transaction with Northern Lights. In addition, I should probably update you that since the last time we met with the board, we've hired a couple of senior investment professionals. One, John Hendrickson, was one of Aether's first investment analysts. He actually left Aether to go back to business school at the University of North Carolina. When he got his MBA, he came back to Aether as an investment director. And so in that role, he is managing our investment process and overseeing Aether's three investment analysts, as well as helping Sean and Troy on the portfolio management side. In addition, we've hired Kristen Federer as operations director. So Kristen was previously a senior member of BlackRock Alternative Advisors operational due diligence group in Seattle. She joined us in the fall of 2014. And is basically going to be running our operational due diligence on underlying managers, as well as doing all of the fund and firm financial operations for us, and overseeing our service provider. She has a real strong background in tax, fund accounting, and fund operations. So with those senior hires, we're up to 8 people on the team today, the most that we've had at Aether to date. All those bios are in the book, but in the interest of time, I think we can skip through those and probably go forward to page 6, where Sean can talk about the commodities market.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
So flipping to page 6, the chart on this page shows commodity prices over a long time period, and it summarizes liquid commodity prices as measured by the Bloomberg Commodity Total Return Index, which is a very diversified commodity index, and it's the orange line on this chart. The other lines on this page represent the subindices to that index, or the metal, energy, and agriculture components of the Bloomberg Commodity Total Return Index. So Troy and I have been investing in this asset class for a long time now, really since about the midpoint of this chart. And over time, we become conditioned to expect the volatility that's inherent in our space and obvious when you look at the price trends on this page. Volatility in the natural resource or commodity sectors is really associated with the long lead times required in order to bring new production or new supply online, to develop new mines, develop new oil fields. These long cycles create the associated commodity price volatility as markets move from periods of being oversupplied to being undersupplied relative to demand. But it's this volatility that creates opportunities for our fund managers, because while demand growth also fluctuates over time, by and large, the demand trends across our spaces is generally positive, generally up. We will consume more commodities globally this year than we did last, and we will likely consume more commodities next year globally than we will this year. The key to profiting from this dynamic over time is to be a long-term patient investor, but more on that in a minute. You know, the second observation I would make is the various commodity or resource markets are not perfectly correlated with each other. And again, this is also obvious by looking at the chart on this page. The energy, metal, and agriculture markets do not move perfectly in tandem with one another over time. In fact, the average rolling three-year correlation between these sub-indices is about 0.5 over this entire chart, and it ranges from 0.3 to 0.7. So accordingly for us, we believe that over time, we can reduce the volatility or risk inside of our portfolios by being diversified across the resource landscape, which is why we focus on three areas within the natural resource space: energy, metals, as well as agriculture. So unfortunately, it's impossible to time perfectly these price trend shifts, but the metric that we tend to focus on in order to help us determine whether markets feel frothy or whether they feel cheap is the marginal cost of production, or for the oil industry, for example. How much does it cost the oil industry to produce that next barrel of oil to meet that next barrel of oil demand? Unfortunately for our funds to date, as you can see, ARA 1, ARA 2, and ARA 3, they've all suffered from commodity price declines over the periods of those funds' life. In fact, many commodities are down over 50% from their near-term highs. Luckily, though, we think those funds are still performing very strong despite this headwind. But what about today's market? What does it mean for ARA 3, which is an ARA 3 surplus, which are the funds in which you're invested right now with us, and ARA 4, the new fund we're launching? And I think to talk about how we feel about the market, the best thing I can do is to provide you with an observation that we're seeing in our space right now. Nickel is a metal that we have exposure to across a number of our funds. The current price of nickel as traded on the London Metal Exchange is just under $10,000 a ton. Now, at $10,000 a ton, if you look at most of the analyst reports, they would tell you that about 50% of the nickel industry is currently producing at a cash loss today. Half the industry loses money for every ton of nickel they take out of the ground. And again, our space is one where everything we ultimately produce is a depleting asset, and the growth trends for almost everything our managers produce is going up over long periods of time. So how long can prices stay so low such that 50% of the industry produces at a loss? Or do you, in other words, do you believe that over the near term, the medium term, do you think that 50% of the nickel industry goes away tomorrow? We don't. To us, it represents a really interesting opportunity, one where ultimately we believe prices have to correct in order to spur new development to feed into this new demand that we are likely to see over time. So it's an interesting dynamic that we think we're going to take advantage of for our next couple of funds.
How do you answer your own question about how long that condition can persist?
So that's the hard part, and that's the part about being patient. And I would tell you that in metal markets, the period of bringing new mines online is longer than how long it takes to bring new oil fields online, which is longer than how long it takes to bring new farm fields online. So the cycles in the metal industry tend to persist over longer periods of time. We've been in a down cycle now on the metal side for about 2 to 3 years. We think there's another 2 to 3 years to go before the cycle begins to correct and we experience the next upturn. accordingly for us, we would expect to see our managers do a lot more acquisitions over the next couple of years than dispositions, in hopes of developing mines to a stage where they would be very, very attractive to producers once the market does start to rebound. We think it's a great time to invest in mining, actually.
Sean, do you have any concern about China and the, at least the general published information that they may have been in a commodities bubble? They are now diminishing fairly rapidly, and the purchases they have made over the last few years were unnatural and unsustainable.
Yeah, it's definitely a concern, but I think our conclusion would generally be, yes, we expect the demand growth coming from China to lessen, but we still expect there to be, over the medium term, demand growth overall out of China. The hard part is, again, figuring out exactly what that demand growth looks like. But given where prices are right now, the industry has definitely pulled back exploration and development budgets, so you're not seeing hardly any investment in new development and new mining projects that will ultimately be the projects that need to come online 5-6 years from now in order to satisfy the demand we expect to materialize in 5 or 6 years. I'd admit that currently it looks like that demand will be a little bit less than what the market might have predicted a couple of years ago, but we would still, again, expect there to be more commodity demand at that point in time than what we're experiencing today. Accordingly, we produce, our managers produce depleting assets. They ultimately have to reinvest in their space in order to keep up with that demand. And at today's prices, no one is incentivized to put a new nickel mine in the ground.
Your underlying funds, what are the fee arrangements with them as far as, is it on committed capital? Is it invested capital? What's the carry? Is there a conflict between waiting if to invest if it's an extended period of time, as opposed to gaining higher fees if they invest in the short term?
It's a great question, and one, it's a dynamic that we focus on a lot. And I would say generally our managers are a blend of committed and invested capital. It usually starts out as committed capital and eventually turns into an invested capital fee charge once they are through the investment period of the fund. You know, I think for us, and what I'll talk about in a couple of pages, is we have a bias towards smaller fund managers.
One quick point on that, just to give you a sense, in ARA 3, the management fee that we pay to underlying funds and the carry that we pay to underlying funds, on average, is about a 15% discount to what other investors in those funds pay. So we have been able to negotiate pretty aggressively with many of those funds.
Wow.
So in a couple pages, you know, my goal was to talk a little bit about our biases and how our managers add value. And one of the points I wanted to make is one where, you know, again, in order to profit from the cyclicality of our industry, you have to be a long-term investor and you have to be patient. One of our big biases is towards investing in smaller fund managers for a number of reasons. One of the points I was going to make there relates to their ability to be patient if they're raising small amounts of capital. And the dynamic we really like to foster is one where the management fee keeps the lights on, but where they're clearly incentivized through the profit participation they get by achieving investment results in their funds. Now, managers of larger funds, we know, because we've literally talked to principals that admitted that their number one goal is getting to that next fund as quickly as they possibly can and raising a fund that's bigger than the last, because they know that their primary generator of wealth over time is going to be through ever-increasing management fees. The other dynamic that we're mindful of is if you listen to the teams those big funds are backing, those teams are often telling us that, yeah, they want to give me a lot more money than I can possibly prudently invest at this point in time, because we know full well that those large fund managers feel pressure to get money out the door. Now, by focusing on smaller managers, focused on smaller, right-sized funds, we think it allows those managers to be patient during the cycle and not feel pressure to get money out the door. Very important to us.
We really, just to be clear, though, we would love to get capital deployed today in oil and gas mining. You know, that I think if there's a tension, we feel less concerned about that tension today, because we do think it's a great time to deploy capital. As Sean mentioned, the greater concern would be if a fund manager raised too much money and it takes them a lot longer to deploy capital.
But it sounds like the price of patience is paying the freight. It's paying the fees, right?
At times.
I'm sorry, I had a follow-up. I apologize. Is there a completely different question? Is there a driver in the nickel market like an OPEC or a burgeoning natural gas industry that changes the landscape of how people react? I mean, I think a lot of people thought that what the Saudis and the OPEC countries were doing was counterintuitive, which was blow out the doors when the price is, you know, falling like crazy.
Yep.
And the thought to be reason for that was that the goal was to bust the shale fields, all of those guys. Didn't happen really, or at least it hasn't reached fruition. So I guess, you know, that's that story. I don't know anything about nickel other than that I have a few in my pocket for historical purposes. What are the drivers in that market?
Yeah, it's an interesting question because it's a very complicated market. And frankly, you know, diving into nickel literally is starting to go down that proverbial rabbit hole. You just don't know exactly where it's going to go. The key drivers over the past few years have been Indonesia. And there's a lot of supply within Indonesia that at times ebbs and flows due to regulations that are imposed by the Indonesian government, some of the most recent of which relate to companies within Indonesia needing to also build processing plants for the metals they're producing and process them in Indonesia before exporting out of Indonesia versus what most producers have done here recently, which is preferably just produce the commodity in Indonesia but process it elsewhere more closer to the end user. So for a point in time, that actually brought a lot of the supply in the nickel market down, increased prices, and accordingly led to a lot of incentives for a lot of new nickel production to be brought online. One of those sources of new production is actually something called nickel pig iron, which is a low-grade, low-quality nickel metal that is environmentally hazardous given how it's produced and is really only found in a handful of areas, one of which is China. Now, the good thing about that new supply, nickel pig iron, that came online here over the past few years is there is a finite supply of those opportunities globally, and it seems as if the market is starting to peak in terms of its production of nickel pig iron, and we're sort of exhausting that cheap supply pretty quickly here. So net-net, we think that the market is starting to become more imbalanced from a supply standpoint. Prices have to increase if you want to ultimately be willing to expand operations and invest in new mines.
But you don't have cartel action. You don't have those kinds of players in that market.
No, it's fairly fragmented.
Sean, you've made a number of references to having capital deployable for new mines. But you've also painted a picture of an industry which is roughly 50%, you're saying, of the guys are running at a loss.
Right.
And I'm having a little trouble picturing those 50% running their mines at full capacity and just generating that loss. Mm-hmm. So some of those mines must have been allowed to reduce production. And so isn't there capacity there? Does it all have to be in new mines? Or can it be to making sure that you are economically making the most of the existing mines?
Yeah, it's likely to be a little of both. And it's sort of emblematic, too, of what happened in the oil space, where oil has grabbed all the headlines over the last 10 months, given the precipitous decline in oil prices. What happened in oil is prices got to be so high that it really incentivized producers to develop the most marginal opportunities. I mean, at $100 oil, everything looked economic. So when prices were that high, you did have a lot of producers out there that were willing to bet on increasing pricing going forward and therefore building new oil and gas operations that were only sustainable at those high prices. As prices corrected, those are the first facilities that have come offline.
So could you possibly see a parallel here?
Absolutely.
As you've got these new mines that are being funded with our commitments, mm-hmm. then you don't have the capacity to justify their development.
Well, they have to justify,
justify
their development at lower prices, and they can't look at themselves as the marginal producer in this space. So when we are testing managers on their assumptions related to developing those new mines, again, going back to that marginal cost of production dynamic, the thing we usually say is, okay, where are you on that marginal cost curve? And if they are in the lower half of that marginal cost curve, we usually feel pretty safe. But if they're at the 90th or 80th percentile of the cost curve, meaning that
prices need to be high for a long period of time in order to really justify the build of that new mine,
not where you want to be.
That's when we start to get skittish.
I think another dynamic is that in a low price environment like we have today, many existing mines will target, you know, not all mines are homogenous. The rock quality and the concentration of nickel may vary in different parts of the mines. So many of those mines will go after the highest grade that they can today to try and lower their kind of per unit cost. But that has a negative impact in the future in that they've effectively increased their cost for future production. So that has an impact on supply down the road as well, because while they may be able to lower their cost today, they're looking at even higher costs to sustain production in the future.
Thanks.
So, you know, that's generally, I think, that nickel story is emblematic across a number of different metal markets. Oil and gas, I kind of mentioned what's happened in oil and gas recently. We are starting to see similar production cutbacks in the oil and gas space. The metric we like to follow there, particularly in the U.S., is the oil rig count. And as of today, the oil rig count is down 60% from this point last year, which means that there is a lot less development that's going on, which we view as a positive sign for longer-term pricing trends. The ag market is harder to talk about since it's much more of a heterogeneous market. Frankly, what is happening in citrus in California and the dynamics driving that market are just different than the citrus properties that we own in Florida, where one is all about water supply, as you well know, and the other, frankly, is all about disease and things like that more down in Florida. So what I would say is that we feel great about mining. We feel great about relatively good, I guess, maybe guardedly optimistic about oil and gas. And frankly, and when it comes to agriculture, it's a bit of a mixed bag, and we're pretty opportunistic there. So, you know, in summary, again, looking at this chart, our space has always been, and we think will always be, pretty volatile. But if you're a patient long-term investor, you can capitalize on that volatility. One of the keys to us is making sure that you properly diversify, even within your resource portfolio, across the energy, metal, and agriculture markets. And again, there are a number of dynamics, like the one I described in nickel, across a number of different commodities in which we invest. So while to date, commodity prices have been a headwind to us, we think that the timing couldn't be better for Area 3 and our new fund, Area 4. So maybe quickly switching to page 6, just to touch a little bit on our biases and how we view our managers as adding value. I kind of already talked a little bit about the small fund bias and the keys there
page,
being...
Page 8.
Page 8. I talked a little bit about our small fund bias, and the key to us there is alignment with our managers, making sure their incentives are aligned with ours, the ability to raise right-sized funds and be patient investors. But the other thing is that over the course of my career, Troy's career, we've just noticed that there's greater inefficiencies in the small end of the market as well, both in terms of operational inefficiencies at the property level, but certainly also how deals are bought and sold. At the big end of the market, everything is through multiple investment banks. You're going into a data room along with 30 or 40 of your best friends. 10 guys are bidding on the same asset, and it goes to the highest bidder, versus most of our managers that directly negotiate their transactions one-on-one with the seller. Much more favorable dynamic. The second bias that's important to us is aligning ourselves with groups that have deep operational and technical expertise in the sectors in which they invest. And that's because for us, it's really important for these groups to be able to add value at the asset level after they buy an asset and before they sell the asset in a very hands-on way. And frankly, by adding value at the asset level, we think those managers can create a return component that's independent of the commodity price return component, or basically gives us a bit of a cushion from pure commodity price movements and what that could do to our returns over time. So if you were to look at the resumes of our teams, they have been mining engineers before, they've been reservoir engineers, geologists, they've run oil and gas companies, they've been farm managers before they became investors in the energy, metal, or agriculture spaces. Our guys are not ex-investment bankers from Wall Street. That's not a profile we favor. And then finally, there are a couple of things we look to avoid. Number one is leverage. We don't like it. We don't like our managers to use it. I think by and large, the leverage levels across our managers inside of our portfolios is very, very low relative to other private capital asset classes. And number two is technology risk. So things like clean tech or some of the new energy technologies out there are things that we avoid. Frankly, that kind of risk is probably more appropriate for a venture capital portfolio, certainly the kind of risk that we want to take inside of our fund.
page 9 lays out a few things that we think differentiate Aether. I'll try and move this, move through this pretty quickly to get us back towards the timeline that Tim and Jeff asked us to shoot for. The David mentioned that we focus only on real assets. Our team is focused on one area and one product only. That focus allows us to understand, we think, more deeply the sectors that we consider investing in. It allows us to build deeper relationships within those segments. And it also, the byproduct probably is greater accountability within our team. We're not sharing across products. There are two aspects to our process, though, that I think differentiate us most. The first is investment sourcing. We employ a very proactive approach to sourcing, and we focus on a couple avenues that we view as kind of non-traditional sourcing channels. One is industry conferences, so going to conferences that those same technical people Sean mentioned would attend, rather than LP and fund manager type conferences. And the other is developing a deep network of industry contacts in the areas that we operate in. Sean mentioned engineers, geologists, appraisers, et cetera, basically people who touch assets in those areas. Some of the best opportunities that we've seen historically have come through those industry, that industry network. The other area that I think differentiates us is our due diligence process. The process is comprised of, you know, all the aspects that you would expect to see, you know, meetings, site visits, operational reviews, legal negotiations, et cetera. But I think it's a reference process that differentiates us the most. That process really starts with preparing for references. The process of preparing for references, in many cases, can take almost as much time as the references themselves will take, and that approach is very systematic. It's detailed media reviews, reviewing connections within our database, evaluating common past employment, et cetera. Once we're done with that, it's not uncommon to start with a list of, say, 200 to 300 potential references, which we'll whittle down to generally 50 or 60 that we want to reach out to, that we think are the best potential objective references, and then we seek to do north of 30 references per group that we invest with, which we're averaging significantly greater than 30 on average, and 90% of those are off-list references. That's really important. It's not the list that the fund manager provides to us. It's people we identify on our own that should presumably be more objective.
Well, and with that, how often do you find that the references that they provided don't sync with the ones that you go off of the
project? We've seen it in the past. The process that we've employed have turned up all sorts of things. We've heard comments that the guy's a crook, he should be in jail.
Well, and that's helpful to know.
certainly their listed references would not say that, or they've chosen very, very poorly.
If there's a number below their picture,
generally, the way it works is we'll do a set of references, call it 15-ish references. We'll see what the key themes are, what the key concerns might be. Right. And then we'll readdress our reference list and see if any changes in people that we've identified might be appropriate to get at those specific issues.
Interesting.
It's a part of the process that I think we enjoy the most, candidly, as well. It's something we take a lot of pride in.
And there's no doubt that as a result of reference calls, we have killed a number of opportunities.
Well, and that's critical, particularly when you're dealing with mines and other areas where there's the potential out there for easily due diligence.
The next page summarizes the information that's contained in our database, looking at page 10. The database is, you can use with religion and Aether. All of our due diligence and monitoring flows through the database. The first panel shows just the growth of real assets universe. That's only funds that we can consider within our mandate. So private equity funds, real estate funds, none of that's included in this count. We're well over 1,500 funds at this point. The second panel shows connections. That's the relational aspect of our database, and it helps us track non-obvious relationships between individuals. If we heard that Joe knows Bob, we'll create that connection in our database, and you can see that we're now either approaching or at 10,000 of those connections. We use that very, very actively for references as well. And then the third panel shows the number of contacts in our database. We track those by sector, function, geography. Again, back to the reference concept, we can run reports in our database that allow us to identify people in a specific area with specific functions to their job that might help us evaluate a team.
Can I ask a quick follow-up question to Candace's question? Do you find that there's within an industry, or there are industries that are more critical for that background check, or are there shady actors in about the same percentage in every industry? Or do you look at oil and say, you know, it's oil?
I'd say the mining space has bad. Well, and it has more to do with geography than it does with the industry.
Even within like North America, focuses here.
Well, I guess what I'm getting at is mining tends to be more global in nature.
Yeah.
So you end up, you know, investing in some geographies that Westerners might sit and take a deep breath when they look at it. But they're first world mining jurisdictions. The economies are totally dependent on the mining industry, and if there's anything that they're not going to touch, it's the mining industry.
Thanks.
So,
you're talking like bribes and stuff like that going on?
Corruption is the key issue. Yeah. One other thing I want to touch on very briefly here is monitoring. So we track on a quarterly basis every underlying investment in every portfolio that we invest in. We're updating, you know, the characteristics of those deals, valuations of those deals. It allows us to ask more informed questions about the managers that we're investing with, evaluate progress in deals over time, get snapshots of entire portfolios over time. It's a pretty interesting tool that, you know, we're just now starting to really see the value of, because it's 7 years now of aggregated data, so 3 or 4 years ago it was less valuable than it is today. But we sit on advisory committees for all but a couple of the funds that we've invested in, and we try and rotate those. But if you're going to do that, you have to have good information sharing across your team, and the database really helps facilitate that from a monitoring perspective. I think the next page discusses the structure and strategy for Area 4. This page is almost identical to what you would have seen for Aether Real Assets 1, 2, and 3, and surplus, for that matter. The only real difference with respect to surplus funds is a bit greater concentration. As a reminder, we focus on primarily upstream segments, so as close to the point of commodity production as we can get. We generally make 10 to 15 commitments, generally more like 10 to 12 in any of the funds that we invest in. Area 3 is tracking to 11 investments. Surplus is comprised of 7 investments. Area 3 surplus is comprised of 7 investments. And like in the past, at least 70% of the portfolio will be invested in the primary sectors you see of oil and gas, metals and minerals, ag, timber. There's some other areas that we'll consider. Those would be opportunistic areas. We refer to them as opportunistic areas. Those can include, for example, power or water. That really is a cap, though. That 30% really is a cap. It's possible in Area 3 we may make no opportunistic investments because of the appeal of the oil and gas and mining space today. I would say, if anything, it's probably 1 or 0, the number of allocations we make in the opportunistic space in Area 3. We'll consider any geography, we'll consider secondaries. We did close 2 secondaries in Area 3. Surplus participated in one of those. At the end of the day, our goal continues to be to produce a 12 to 15% return net of all fees and expenses in a period where we don't face a headwind or a tailwind for commodity prices. Obviously, a tailwind would produce better returns. Should be expected to produce better returns than a headwind. You know, obviously, we could find ourselves in a position where we struggle to achieve that.
Page 13, if we fast forward to that page, gives us a snapshot of those returns across Aether's funds to date. So you can see this table is as of March 31. We actually just got updated 6/30 numbers I can share with the board. So if you look at the bottom row of that table, the net IRR for Area 1 as of 6/30 is positive 6.7%. So it's come up just a little from 3/31. Likewise, the net IRR for ARA 2 as of 6/30 is negative 0.2%, or just about flat. And then IRRs for ARA 3 and ARA 3 surplus were as of 6/30, 6.3% and 9.1%, respectively. So the reason we show them as not applicable on this page is that typically we don't show performance in our materials until the sooner of a fund being 3 years into its life or a third call, either of which ARA 3 or surplus have hit yet. That's just because early in the life of the fund, the fees and expenses are mismatched against the pace of capital investment, so the IRRs really aren't very meaningful. So these IRRs are likely to change quite a bit, but they're directionally headed in the right way. They're positive today. So we want to share those with the board.
The difference between 3 and the main fund and the surplus, 11 investments as opposed to 7 investments, where's the concentration, the difference between the two?
So the surplus fund effectively sits behind ARA 3 from an allocation priority perspective. Right. So there were a few opportunities in ARA 3 that were capacity constrained, mm-hmm. and there was no remaining capacity after ARA 3 had made its commitment.
The greater surplus is a bit more concentrated in the mining space.
That was my question. Okay.
We're outsized investments in surplus relative to the main fund.
Okay.
And it was really because of that conviction that we had in the mining space. Well, two considerations: the conviction that we had in the mining space, and we wanted to make sure that we weren't waiting until the end of the life of ARA 3 to make sure that surplus was fully committed. We didn't want any potential for conflict at the end. We realized after this, really the third commitment, that there were going to be a broader set of opportunities to consider overlap between surplus and 3 than we might have expected going in. So we backed that off and decided to diversify the portfolio a bit more.
So for 4, do you see a need for a surplus fund at this point for 4?
You know, there's not a need. It's worked out very effectively for 3, though. That discount on fees that I mentioned, there's no doubt in my mind that those discounts would have existed, but not to the same degree without surplus. So being able to write a bigger check in many of the funds we invest in, it's a great tool to have. We'd love to have it. But we've never kind of said this has to be part of our business plan. The right circumstances exist to have it. It's additive for everyone, but our business plan certainly isn't dependent on it.
I'm seeing fund number 2 in less than 6 months has obviously got a better rate of return. What did you attribute that to?
Fund 2?
Yeah, I'm looking at you. Would you say it's the updated?
The IRR for ARA 2 is a negative 0.2%. So just about
that's kind of significantly better. But what's it attributed to? I don't know.
Mostly oil and gas and sort of the brief commodity price uplift we had as of June 30th, which has subsequently come down a little bit. But since our managers have to mark to market their books as of quarter end, given where oil and gas prices were as of 6/30, they were able to write up their books a little bit due to the brief temporal spikes that we saw then. So we would expect that to come down a little bit, given oil and gas prices have come down subsequent to the end of that quarter.
Just to real quickly to provide some context around those performance numbers, Sean mentioned earlier the Bloomberg Commodity Total Return Index as being kind of a liquid proxy for our liquid strategy. Had you invested in that index over the life of each of our funds on a dollar for dollar basis, so as you contribute a dollar to Aether or distribute a dollar from A3, did the same in the benchmark, we would have outperformed the benchmark in ARA 1 by about 9.5%, ARA 2 by about 6.7%. And so far in ARA 3 and 3 surplus by between 16 and 19%. So certainly pretty pleased with that on an apples-to-apples basis against the benchmark from a dollar-weighted annualized perspective.
The Bloomberg benchmark is not private. That's a public.
It's liquid futures in various commodities. Nearing the end here, page 18 shows our investment pipeline as of the end of last month. And, at the top, we, note that we've seen a lot of opportunities since the inception of our firm. Frankly, much more than this number if we also were to include secondaries and co-investments, which aren't included in this metric. But as of the end of last month, we're in active due diligence on 21 opportunities. In terms of where we're finding these deals or a pipeline by source, certainly a pretty diversified mix of sourcing channels. But as Troy noted earlier, you know, our favorite ways of sourcing managers are through our networks of industry relationships. So, you know, the number of opportunities we're looking at through referrals, as well as those that are existing relationships, those are probably the best of the 21 that we're currently looking at right now. In terms of pipeline by strategy and geography, what I would note on strategy is a pretty diversified mix of opportunities again, although heavily dominant in our primary sectors of energy, metals, and agriculture, as you should be led to expect. And in terms of geography, really a good mix of North American and non-North American opportunities. Our portfolios have definitely become a little bit more international over time. Frankly, the opportunity set is global, so that's not surprising at all. In terms of what we're focused on today, you know, we think we probably initiated diligence on what will be the final commitment to ARA 3 here very recently, which means that after you take away that one investment, the other 20 on this page are really opportunities we're likely to consider for ARA 4. And in terms of expectations for the potential first couple commitments in ARA 4, you know, two in particular I'd mention. One is a Canadian oil and gas group we've been following for a while. That looks pretty interesting, but the one that's the most interesting is likely to be a re-up with a manager we committed to in ARA 1 and ARA 2 in the North American oil and gas segment. And I think if you polled our firm, everybody would say this is our favorite manager. It's the manager in which we have the most conviction and is one of the best performing managers across all of our funds. So it's exciting that it could end up being one of the, if not the first investment we make out of our fourth fund. You know, in the interest of time, I would probably say maybe just turn it over to you, Dave, to wrap up with a summary of what we're there for.
Real quick question: any exposure to rare earths at all in the?
A little bit in our first fund through one investment we have there, and in what was a very high profile rare earth development project. Not nearly as much in ARA 2 or ARA 3. A little bit of exposure to mineral sands, which is different, but only modest exposure to rare earths.
With regards to the pipeline by source, the largest piece is through placement agents. Yep. That is a result of the size of these funds. They don't have internal salespeople. They farm it out to.
In part, the big guys want to raise big funds, and when you see that dynamic, they usually need to hire, you know, the Wall Street placement agent guys to help them go out and you know, raise the billions they're ultimately looking for. For our groups that are trying to raise 250, 200, it's not nearly as critical for them.
That tends to be passing, though. So if you took a snapshot every week, it'll change pretty dramatically, and that placement agent category tend to be the ones that fall off the pipeline.
So this pipeline by source is not necessarily your pipeline.
This is a snapshot of one day,
okay.
Which was the at the end of August.
Just a quick question. Canada brought it to mind. As an individual, if you own Canadian stocks, unless you own them in an IRA or a qualified plan, you have 15% withholding. I assume you have that at various other countries around the world. Are you exempt from that? How do you deal with those kinds of issues?
We're not exempt from it. We at least have put a wholly owned sub in place that files taxes in Canada so that individual investors don't have the administrative burden. We really have to view it as an extra cost. We have to have that much more confidence in a Canadian opportunity than we do in a U.S. opportunity. It's really good.
For some of our U.S. investments and all of our international investments, we engage EY. There are tax attorneys and consultants to help us figure out the structuring around those investments and those types of dynamics, because we definitely look at opportunities on an after-tax basis.
Okay. Page 23 and 24 have a summary of terms for ARA 4 and ARA 4 surplus. These are going to be identical to the terms for ARA 3 and ARA 3 surplus. The only difference being in ARA 4, we increased the hard cap slightly from 300 to 350. And each time we sit down and determine the hard cap, we look at the most capacity-constrained underlying fund opportunity we expect to have in that fund, and we size the hard cap such that that commitment can still be a core allocation of somewhere between 6 to 12%. So our hard cap's not determined by how much capital we think we can raise. It's determined by the underlying fund commitments we think we're going to make. The fee structure is the same as with ARA 3. It starts at 85 basis points on committed capital for the first 5 years and steps down by 15% each year thereafter. That averages out to about 63 basis points on committed capital over the life of ARA 4. The preferred return is 5%, but only after our investors have received all their contributed capital back, including fees and expenses, and after they've been paid a 7% preferred return.
And committed means called.
Yeah, David, you said a 5% preferred return, 5% carried interest.
Sorry, misspoke. Yeah. Excuse me. Yeah, 5% carried interest. Apologize. And 7% preferred return to our investors.
And again, I'm sorry, committed means called or the total initial commitment?
Initial commitment.
In our first fund, we had a structure of fee on committed capital converting to a fee on net invested capital. There were a couple of cases that gave us discomfort with the structure of our fee tied to invested capital because there were some judgment calls about what net invested capital really was. When we got to our second fund, we decided to convert to a structure that was based on committed capital entirely, but we wanted to make sure if we did that, that the aggregate all-in fees were lower. Obviously, it's a big benefit to us. We have transparency into the fee structure. So we modeled it. We basically picked a model that resulted in a very similar aggregate fee stream over the life of the fund, but a little bit lower than our model suggested that it was, would have been for Area 1. So trading some transparency, objectivity for what, you know, what we think is a bit of a discount relative to the fee on net investment.
And then very briefly, the next page just shows the surplus fees. You'll notice they're a little bit less than ARA 4 for the reason Troy described earlier, that that fund is expected to have slightly higher concentration. So the trade-off there is a lower fee structure. And over the life of ARA 4, we expect that management fee will average about 44 basis points on committed capital. We'll be making GP commitments to both funds. And that commitment, as I mentioned earlier, will be funded entirely by Aether's employee team. I think it'll be about $3.5 million for ARA 4, and it'll depend on the size of the surplus fund. But our commitment will be there.
That's it for our prepared remarks.
Those are big investments for us, by the way. Those will be material for everyone.
One question. You seem to put too much emphasis on technology. I saw a documentary the day we had this mining equipment for miners. Don't even go to mines anymore. You're just drilling through there. How are you foreseeing all that stuff when you're doing these investments? Like what's currently taking place, what's down the road that may impact it?
Yeah, the best example is really what's happened over the last 5 to 10 years in the oil and gas space with horizontal drilling and multi-stage fracture completions, and how that's really been a step change for what wasn't economic previously to develop without that technology versus what's now economic today. And that led to one of those boom supply cycles that I kind of talked about a little bit earlier that ultimately led to oversupply and the price corrections we're going through right now as the market became oversupplied. On the mining side, there hasn't been the same types of technological or even technique innovations that we've seen on the oil and gas side. The ones that we do tend to see tend to be very specific to a very specific type of metal or mineral, like a new rare earth processing technique that allows you to drive better performance out of rare earth mines. But there hasn't been the same sort of step change or paradigm shift across the metal industry due to one new technology or technique that we have seen in oil and gas in the last decade or so.
So if there's times, like say technology gets good, you can say there's more supply, therefore price going up, but also becomes more affordable, it may be used in other markets. So
yep. Absolutely.
It's interesting. In the oil and gas space, generally that horizontal drilling has allowed for those reserves to be exploited more economically, but they're still not the lowest cost production. That stuff will go away, and I think OPEC has targeted that, as was alluded to earlier. In the mining space, it's still about moving earth, and you know, there are only so many ways you can increase the economics. It tends to be extraction, but the real bulk of the cost is in any kind of earth moving.
Yep.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you all very much. Yeah, I appreciate it.